It's a moving monster. The station fire devours ridge after ridge.
Hi, this is Ivan Semenik. Welcome to the Universe in Mind. So, if you've ever wondered what an astronomer's nightmare sounds like, not too long ago, all you had to do was switch on the news.
And the renowned Mount Wilson Observatory, it's perched high above Pasadena. Firefighters have been mounting a war to save the top of that mountain.
NBC all crews have left. When it hits, it might be extremely intense. It's in fate's hands now. Facing a
wall of flame. The so-called station fire began in late August in the San Gabriel Mountains north of Los Angeles. To date, it's burned 65,000 hectares of forest, destroyed 89 homes, and caused the deaths of two firefighters who were killed when their truck careened off a mountain road as they were trying to escape the flames. By August 31st, the fire appeared to be on the verge of consuming the Mount Wilson Observatory, one of the world's most famous and historically significant scientific institutions. But incredibly, almost miraculously, the observatory escaped destruction at the 11th hour, and just recently it was declared safe from the station fire. It was a harrowing moment in the very place where astronomer Edwin Hubble once helped to usher in the modern universe. And though the observatory's predicament captured worldwide attention during the fire, it's likely no one felt the danger quite as intensely as the staff of Mount Wilson. To tell us more, we've reached Dr. Harold McAllister. He's the director of the Mount Wilson Institute and an astronomer at Georgia State University. He joins us now from Atlanta. Dr. McAllister, thank you so much, and welcome to the Universe in Mind.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
You must be incredibly relieved at this point that Mount Wilson Observatory is now in the clear.
Well, it's really hard for me to describe the feeling. It was such an up-and-down roller coaster ride, and it's been really more than a month since that fire was lit, and you know it was arson. It was not a natural fire. And at certain points we thought we were, well, at one point the observatory was predicted to be doomed by the press and actually by fire officials, but nature in its capricious manner decided to avoid the mountain this time with a station fire. So we're very, very lucky, and the outcome, it's just hard for me to think about other than a positive outcome.
So if we were standing on Mount Wilson today in the vicinity of the observatory looking around, what would we see? What kind of evidence of the fire would there be, and how different does the observatory look now than it did a few months ago?
If you stand on the north side of the observatory, in fact, there's some promontories where you can look off to the north and the northwest and the northeast. To the north and northwest, and much to the northeast, as far as the eye can see, is just burned out devastation. Just desolation. And if you scan around to the east and the southeast, you see where the fire didn't reach into the foothill areas and on down into the populated areas. And the contrast between the green areas and the ashen areas is just stark. The observatory itself there was no wildfire that reached the observatory grounds. However, there were backfires that were set by firefighters to deplete the ground level fuels that would have had a wildfire come up the mountain. These would have allowed the flames to reach up and get into the canopy of the trees, and so they burn out these low lying areas of grass and small bushes, and so it has kind of a scorched look. But that'll recover very quickly. In fact, we were delighted they did that. It gave us a very important added safety buffer.
Now, for those of us who are following the fire online, it was quite a dramatic week in early September. And, of course, for a while you could even see the state of the fire with a webcam that was at the observatory. I wonder if you could recap the events for us, you know, especially there were those critical few days where it really seemed like things might not go well for the observatory. And what happened and how fast did things happen?
It was the last weekend in August when 3 days in a row the observatory was evacuated, and the low point came on Monday morning after we had allowed our staff to go back and assist firefighters. And I should say that several of our staff members, our superintendent David Jurasevich, and then the char site manager Larry Webster, along with an assistant superintendent named Jake Hodge, were on the mountain whenever there were firefighters there, and they were needed to assist firefighters with mountain infrastructure. We have a firefighting water system and pumps and so forth, and electrical systems, and the firefighters were really relying upon these crucial staff members to make sure things were operating. But Monday morning, it had been determined that the fire would sweep the mountain that day, and everyone was ordered off. The thinking would be they would come back in, say, 24 hours and assess the damage and put out any smoldering ruins that might be present. And that really was a very difficult time for me, as well as for mm-hmm. anyone else involved with the observatory, because there sits this precious entity, this national treasure, international treasure of astronomy, completely exposed to the oncoming fire. And to make it really worse, the tower cam went out at about that time, and so our eye on the mountain died on us. But as I said earlier, the whimsical fire decided not to go over the mountain, and within 24 hours, firefighters were back up, and our staff was back up. But I think for me, that was the low point.
Now, you were saying at one point the press declared the observatory doomed. I mean, how close do you think you came to losing the observatory?
Well, that's difficult to, I think, to really estimate. You know, if you roll the dice and if you had exactly the same scenario repeat itself, the wind blowing a little bit differently, this and that happening differently, it could have been a disaster. The entire north slope of the mountain is full of fuels that haven't burned for, as far as we can tell, more than a century. And they were just sitting there, and if the fire had come very, very close to them, then they would have lit up and swept upslope and swept over the observatory. Many people remember what happened to Mount Stromlo Observatory some years ago. That was an utter disaster. Mount Wilson was not quite as vulnerable as that, but it still would have been a huge loss had the fire gotten up there. But it came very close. The nearest fires were, half a mile away. And there were hot spots on the mountain until just a few days ago. Until last Friday, there were still hot spots around, and they finally things cooled down, and the observatory of the mountain was declared safe at that point.
So what is at stake at Mount Wilson? Of course, many people are aware of the historic significance of the observatory with Edwin Hubble's observations of galaxies there. But what is going on today? What can you give us a sense of what's at stake?
There are four universities that operate research programs on the mountain, in addition to smaller programs as well. But the four primary science efforts, there are two nighttime programs and two daytime programs. The original 60 and 150-foot solar towers are used by scientists from University of Southern California and UCLA to conduct studies of the sun. And those studies have been going on since early in the 20th century, of course. The two nighttime telescopes, the 60 and 100-inch telescopes, are no longer actively used for science. The 100-inch is occasionally, the 60-inch is devoted to an outreach program. And so the nighttime programs are new facilities that are on the observatory grounds but don't use the original old observatory telescopes. One of these is a facility operated by Professor Charles Townes at the University of California, Berkeley. And it is it's an infrared interferometer. And an interferometer, as your listeners may know, is an array of two or more telescopes, and the light is linked together in such a manner as to synthesize, for resolution purposes, a very high-resolution telescope. The second of these facilities is actually my own institution's facility called the CHAR Array, and it is currently the world's most powerful long-baseline optical interferometer. And it works in the near-infrared and in the visible part of the spectrum and synthesizes a telescope with an aperture of about 400 meters, which the largest baselines in the world are involved there. These two facilities, if disaster had swept, these two facilities could have been replaced for a total of $45 or $50 million. So they're replaceable. The 100-inch telescope or the 60-inch telescope, if they had been heavily damaged or destroyed, they couldn't be replaced for any amount of money because their historical significance would have died with them.
And how would you rate the historical significance of the 100-inch telescope?
Well, let me back up to the 60-inch. The 60-inch telescope is really the first modern reflecting telescope. It was the first silver-on-glass mirror. It has a precision drive system and really set a new standard. I think the clock started ticking with the 60-inch on modern telescope technology when that telescope first saw starlight in 1908. It was, of course, the precursor to the 100-inch, and perhaps I'm prejudiced, but I would argue that the 100-inch Hooker telescope at Mount Wilson is the most important telescope since the little ones at Galileo built a few hundred years ago, 400 years ago.
I think you'd have a lot of people agreeing with you on that one.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, it really is. Mount Wilson is where modern astrophysics was invented, and all the great questions that are being answered and still being sought with newer, larger telescopes on the ground in space were really first posed from Mount Wilson Observatory.
So I'm wondering if people had a clear picture of how valuable the observatory is, both historically and in its current incarnation, and whether it took some time for the true nature of the risk to percolate into the public.
I think it's true that it did take some time, and you know, every time I go to, I'm based out of Atlanta, but I go to Southern California a lot, and even in a grocery store, I'll tell people I'm work at Mount Wilson, and they often say, "Oh, I've heard of that. I've never been there. I should go sometime." And it really is it's something that was extremely well known 50 years ago, and it's kind of fallen into obscurity. It's the scientific heritage that was created there has been unknown, except to the astronomical enthusiast. And I think that this event, if there is a silver lining in any dark cloud such as we went through, I think this event has really helped elevate Mount Wilson in the consciousness of the public.
And I know you're also trying to now do some fundraising in the wake of the fire. Can you tell us about that effort?
Sure. In fact, a year and a half ago, we were going to launch a capital campaign to build a modern new visitor center, because we really would like to reawaken the country and even the world to this science heritage site in those mountains up there. We postponed that because the economy went south, as everyone widely knows. And so we've been quiet about that. But during the fire, it occurred to me that we're going to have a lot of cleanup expenses. But even more importantly, we want to do what we can to make sure the observatory is as safe in a future situation like this as it can possibly be. And so we put a fire recovery appeal up on our website, and we've had probably 150 or more donations at present. I'm just overwhelmed with people's generosity.
Now, Dr. McAllister, when we began, we were talking about how lucky you're feeling and how lucky the whole community is feeling that the worst didn't happen. Is there any way to prevent this sort of close call in the future? Is there any way to make the observatory safer from fire?
We, over the past several years, have spent about $250,000 on thinning trees, cutting off what firefighters call ladder fuels that allow a fire starting on the ground to climb up into the branches and crown tops of trees. And we cut much of the observatory plant life to standards set by the federal government for safety. And so we actually had done a pretty good job on making the place as safe as we could. Now, if you look at a photograph of Mount Wilson from the 1930s, an aerial photograph, one is shocked to see that the number of trees, the tree density on the mountain, was far less than it is today, and which is, I guess, the way it is in many national forests. They've been allowed to grow. And so to make the place safer, it basically requires removing trees. And we are in a national forest. The land is owned by the U.S. Forest Service, and you know, we've worked very carefully with those folks to respect the desire to keep as many trees as possible. But this is a situation we'll have to reassess.
Well, Harold McAllister, thank you so much. We wish you good luck with the recovery, and we're glad it's been good news. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, and I appreciate your interest.
As we've just heard from Harold McAllister, it would be hard to understate the historic significance of Mount Wilson. Maybe only Galileo's telescope is more famous. Science writer and award-winning author Marcia Bartusiak has delved into that history in her latest book, The Day We Found the Universe. The book not only deals with Mount Wilson, but the remarkable revolution in American astronomy that began just over a century ago and changed our perception of the cosmos forever. Of course, Edwin Hubble is a key player, but he was far from the only character in what is one of the greatest stories in modern science. Marcia Bartusiak is also an adjunct professor in the graduate program in science writing at MIT, where I paid her a visit earlier this year. Marcia, this is your fifth book, and you've been covering astronomy from A to Z through time. And, of course, this is a very exciting year to be writing about astronomy because it's the International Year of Astronomy, commemorating that big year in 1609 when Galileo first used a telescope and looked at the sky. But that was an entire year. In this book, at least in the title, you've pinpointed things down to one day, the day we found the universe. So I want to ask you about that one day. Obviously, there's more than one day in the book. But what was so important about that day that made it a day that we discovered the universe?
There is a bit of hyperbole here, but something very important happened on that day. Edwin Hubble had gathered data that suggested that the universe was far larger than we had suspected, for sure. People had speculated that there might be other galaxies beyond the borders of the Milky Way. But from about 1900 into the 1920s, the accepted wisdom among the majority of astronomers was that the Milky Way was in a sense the cosmos. But Edwin Hubble, starting in the early 1920s, started gathering data that indeed some of the spiraling nebulae in the sky, two of them in fact, Andromeda and the Triangulum Nebulae, were very, very distant. By his measurements at the time, more than 1 million light years away, which would put it outside the Milky Way. They were other Milky Ways. But he held on to the data for nearly a year without saying a word, except some conversations with his colleagues. He didn't want to publish because he was a little fearful that he was wrong. There was some conflicting data out there that suggested maybe he wasn't right. Then finally, his colleagues twisted his arm and said, "You have to present this data at the next American Astronomical Society meeting," which occurred in Washington, D.C. And January 1st, 1925, was the day when finally his report was initially read to the convening astronomers. What's interesting, though, he wasn't there.
Right, so I this is the curious thing. I want to ask you about this, because this momentous occasion, and this is the one of those moments for which Hubble is so well remembered, but he wasn't there. Why wasn't he there?
He was looking at this conflicting data. It was coming in from a colleague of his right at the Mount Wilson Observatory. This colleague, by the name of Adrian von Manen, was seeing some of the spiraling nebulae actually rotate. Now, of course, spiral nebulae do rotate, but he was seeing it almost in real time, taking photographs from year to year, and he was saying that he was seeing them rotate, which would have been impossible if they were truly far away, because then they would have had to have been rotating faster than the speed of light in order to see motion that quickly.
Right.
Hubble was very concerned about this because this man, von Manen, was an excellent astronomer. He was tops in his field in measuring the positions of things and how they moved on the sky. So Hubble was very, very worried about this, and he didn't want to make any announcement until he could prove to his own satisfaction where von Manen was going wrong. And he couldn't do it. But he grudgingly submitted the paper. It was read. He got a lot of publicity, but in the back of his mind, he was still worried about von Manen's data.
So just to put this in context, everyone at the time accepted that all the stars we see, the Milky Way, was one part of one big galaxy, something that we were part of. But there were these other swirls in the sky, and there was a debate about whether they are also somehow part of the Milky Way or are they entire separate galaxies at some great distance? So Hubble's data suggested they were distant galaxies, but the data that they were rotating or moving would have been impossible if they were really that far away. So how was this resolved?
Hubble was using a new standard for measuring distances in the universe. They're called Cepheid variable stars. By the way that they blink, you know how luminous they are, and therefore you can estimate a distance by seeing how far away, how dim they are, and how far away they must be to be that dim. So he had these standard candles that he was able to use. This was a relatively new development, but it was becoming the gold standard of cosmic measuring tapes in the universe. Once Hubble found Cepheid stars in the Andromeda Nebula and the Triangulum Nebula, he was able to prove to everyone's satisfaction they were truly distant. And the majority of astronomers in the astronomical community pretty much then went to Hubble's side.
Now, what's interesting about this story is, of course, Hubble's so diligently attacking this problem, but it also seems the case that technology and changes in technology also played a role, because Hubble was working with telescopes much larger than had been available before. So George Ellery Hale comes up again and again as being so key by being the person who essentially creates, as you say, as you write, almost single-handedly moves the cutting edge of astronomy from Europe to America with these big telescopes. So how did he achieve this, and what was the impact for Hubble?
Hale is an important figure in the background. Other than the astronomy community himself, people probably aren't aware of his work, but he was almost like the man holding the levers and creating the situation in which this all played out. It was a unique moment this time. I called it the perfect storm of technology, theory, and observations, and also in the economy. This was the great American Industrial Revolution. Money was aplenty. It was the Gilded Age in the end of the 19th century into the 20th. And these men wanted to spend their money to build up their name. And one of the biggest things at that time was to build a telescope on a hill from which everybody could look up and admire. George Ellery Hale knew this. He came from wealth himself, and he went to these wealthy men, men like Yerkes, men like Andrew Carnegie, and he was able to get the wealth to build the biggest and the best telescopes and put them up on a mountain at high altitude, away from atmospheric interference.
And that's so interesting, because you've got this big scientific story that's preceded by the technology story. But as you say, that is in turn preceded by this economic story, that there are these industrialists and financiers at this unique time in American history where the resources are suddenly available for the U.S. to spring ahead of the rest of the world and really make these big discoveries. And I'm curious, why do you think, you talked about the observatory on the hill, but why do you think astronomy among all of the sciences benefited so much from the money that was around at that time?
Well, I think it might have started with James Lick. He was an entrepreneur in San Francisco, the wealthiest man in San Francisco. And he didn't have any legitimate children. He did have an illegitimate son. And he was coming up into his old age wanting to donate his money. His first idea was to build a huge pyramid in the middle of San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, that would have been bigger than the pyramids of Egypt. And he bumped into a man, a geologist actually, who had been roaming through the Sierra Nevada and coming to understand, he was also an amateur astronomer, that the best astronomy could be done at the higher heights. And he got it in his head, this would be wonderful if we could get a telescope on a hill. And this man named Davidson convinced Lick that rather than build the pyramid downtown, it would be better to build this wonderful telescope
right
on a hill. And it finally was built on Mount Hamilton, right above what is now Silicon Valley, outside San Jose, in California. And it got a lot of notoriety. Other rich men in the country started noticing all the publicity that James Lick was getting and the Lick Observatory was getting, and decided, this is the best monument to my ego.
Right.
And so Charles Yerkes...
Forget the pyramids. The new pyramids, well, science is the new pyramid, I guess.
Exactly. Right. Science became, it was an era of great technological advancement, and there were some wonderful, great discoveries being made in these by these telescopes. They were grabbing the headlines weekly and monthly, and this was a great way to attach your name to these wonderful things that were coming out of the observatories. So Charles Yerkes built his observatory. That is where Hale first started working. And there he saw the vision that if I had more money, what would I do? I would go back to California. I would even get another high mountain and I would build a telescope. And he convinced Andrew Carnegie that that would be a great thing. So it was almost a Rolling Stone type of phenomenon that occurred there at the turn of the 20th century.
And then, as you say, these young up-and-comers like Shapley and Hubble were, you know, talented, but also at the right place at the right time to be at the crest of that wave. Now, this is also a story of personalities, though, because these are some really distinct and interesting personalities. Hubble, as an example, you know, you write about him kind of affecting a British accent. And can you flesh out Hubble as a person for us? I mean, for most people, he's still just a name. And was there something about his personality that allowed him to be the one that crossed this conceptual barrier?
Edwin Hubble was born in the Midwest in Missouri. Good, solid, middle-class roots. His father was trained in the law, but ended up working in the family insurance business. And somehow, from an early age, you can see it in all of the reminiscences from his early childhood friends, and also recollections from his siblings, that he had this powerful desire to be singular and distinct. Always wanted to be the top guy. He did very well in high school, got a scholarship to the University of Chicago, and wanted to go into astronomy, but his father was very stern, and he did what his father told him to, and his father said, you go into the law. Well, he did a little of both. He did take all the proper courses for going later into a law degree, but he also took a lot of science courses as well, sort of a dual major. At that time, also, the Rhodes scholarships were coming into play, and he saw this as his chance for notoriety and fame and fortune. So he did everything possible to make himself the best candidate possible. Worked with the top scientists in the laboratories as an assistant. He got into athletics. And he also ran for vice president of his senior class, knowing he would win because he ran unopposed. It did the trick. He got the Rhodes Scholarship, went over to Oxford University for 3 years, and that's where he started being a little, taking on these affectations. He became a real Anglophile, a rabid Anglophile. He started brewing a proper cup of tea. He would wear a cape with great flourish. And he came back from England with a British accent that he never lost for the rest of his life. And his fellow astronomers described him as a stuffed shirt. He did have a very aloof attitude. He thought well of himself. Didn't like to hang out with the other astronomers who... They usually were a sort of happy-go-lucky kind of crowd. Mm-hmm. He preferred hanging out with the British literary crowd in Hollywood. Aldous Huxley was there. He hung out with the top Hollywood stars, Charlie Chaplin, Helen Hayes. He was a social snob.
Interesting. So not just a lonely figure on the mountaintop, but really very much aware of his time and place in society.
Yes.
And also in the book, there are so many other amazing characters that have kind of disappeared into history a little bit around the Hubble name. And you've written about these people before, and you know they are in the pages of astronomical history. In researching the book, did you find out new things about these people, about the Curtises or the Shapleys or others? I mean, were there surprises for you in learning their stories?
I think the biggest surprise to me was James Keeler. This is a man who absolutely is not remembered at all. Others may vaguely get their
And we'll have to ask
name.
You, who is James Keeler?
Who is James Keeler? He was a director of the Lick Observatory. Mm-hmm. And what he did, he was the first one to take a reflecting telescope, had it shipped over from England, schmooze some rich guy over there and told him to donate it to the Lick Observatory, and had it erected on one of the ridges in the shadow of the big 38-inch lensed telescope that was, for a time, the biggest in the world. He let his subordinates continue some very important surveys using that instrument. He went to this little reflecting telescope that nobody else wanted to deal with at all, put it back into condition, and started seeing immense numbers of nebulae on the sky, more than anyone had ever seen. He counted at one point, or estimated at one point, 120,000. Later that would be up to 500,000. Most of them these spiraling disks. He wondered what they were and why he was seeing so many of them. And he would have probably figured it out. He was the top spectroscopist in the world. But he died at the age of 41 or 42
oh my.
In 1900.
Right.
I believe if he had been given a few more years and applied his spectroscopic skills to those spiraling nebulae, we might have found out much earlier that indeed the Milky Way was not alone.
So as it is, instead of the Keeler Space Telescope, we've got the Hubble Space Telescope. And these big, big ideas, the idea that our galaxy is not alone, the universe is much bigger than it looks, and then to top it off, the universe is also expanding, all the galaxies are moving away. These have to rank as some of the biggest ideas in science, you know, like evolution, like the periodic table, like plate tectonics or DNA. They define the entire science, you know, everything makes sense in that light. And all of that happened, you know, just in a few short years. With Hubble being a central character, but many others around him. Marcia, do you think that astronomy will ever, ever see a time like that again? Could astronomers ever top that amazing time and those amazing discoveries?
Having dipped into a lot of history over the last few years, I hesitate to make such a grand statement. It's so easy to say, this is the end, this is the final imprint, the last great discovery in astronomy. Everything else is a cleanup and a tail. Because it's happened so many other times. I can imagine that before Galileo put the telescope to his eye, everyone thought they had pretty much nailed what was happening in the heavens. Mm. And then suddenly it was a whole new ball game. Now we're starting to speculate it may not just be our universe, but perhaps other universes budding off or surrounding us in multidimensional space. We have a multiverse. So I can speculate that this may not be the end at all, that there may be a whole new adventure coming or even another interpretation.
Well, in which case there'll be lots more to write about, either new adventures or new interpretations, which of course is great and great for you and great for us. So, Marcia Bartusiak, thanks for bringing this story back in so much richness, and thanks for speaking to us today.
Thank you, Ivan.
My conversation with Marcia Bartusiak was recorded in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The Day We Found the Universe is published by Pantheon Books. Thank you. And that's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is sponsored by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics and produced here at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget. I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us again soon for more excursions into the realm of astronomical ideas. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.